Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is sports bettor Captain Jack. And it's been about 9 or 10 months since he's visited with us, and he's going to be here again. We received a listener question addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. It asked, Bob, do you have any advice on how I can play video poker faster? The key factors are how well do you know the game, how quickly do you recognize the patterns, and hand-eye coordination. Taking hand-eye coordination goes, if you become a concert pianist, that would probably help you quite a bit. Or if you got really good at games on Nintendo, or maybe get younger, all those things help, but are basically impossible, or just plain practice. I suspect people who can keyboard fast on a computer are faster on video poker machines as well. Key part of speed is pattern recognition. Your delta suited ace 2-3. Do you know that as a three-card straight flush and how it differs or doesn't differ from ace 3-5? Do you know how that combination stacks up with every other possible two cards? Do you see it equally fast if it's in the first three positions in order, or if the three is in the first position, the ace is in the fourth, and the two is in the fifth? It takes a lot of study and a lot of practice to see those things quickly, and every game is different. For most players, speed kills. Playing fast, buttons are much more likely to become unstuck, and you're much more likely to make the wrong play because you just didn't see it at first glance. Bottom line, practice and study are the keys to getting faster, and getting more accurate is usually more valuable than getting faster. All right, let's talk to our guest. Captain Jack began Advantage Play in 1999 as a card counter, and within a few months found bonus hustling on internet casinos. He moved into sports betting primarily but not exclusively on Major League Baseball and the NBA. Captain Jack, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me back, guys. Appreciate it.
Better watch it. We're likely to invite you back again. National Football League. Rule changes this year. Full-time officials, replays handled centrally, overtime length. Will any of those affect handicapping?
The change to the officials is actually being phased in over the next several years. And it's likely that they're going to start with the guys that aren't the faces on TV that we know, the Ed Hockley and Gene Steratore and these kind of officials, these referees, head referees that have kind of become famous or infamous. They're starting with the sideline officials and the field judges. The important part of that whole change, though, is if you read between the lines, this is pretty much the NFL admitting that legalized sports betting is most likely going to happen. Having part-time officials was always a big hole in their integrity, and I think they realize that as more money is going to be wagered on these games, they need to make sure that the officials aren't just these part-time pay-per-game employees. Now, the reviews taking place in the league office in New York City, that may help reduce some of the ambiguity of what is and isn't a catch, but there's really no way to quantify that in a handicapping sense. The big rule change that you mentioned there, though, is overtime rules are changing again. Overtime is going to be reduced now to 10 minutes instead of 15. The other overtime rules where if one team scores via a field goal on their first possession, then the other team gets a chance to counter and go down and either retie the game or win the game with a touchdown. It's pretty easy to see that reducing the amount of time in the overtime period should lead to more ties. That increases the value of the zero in the point spread. Now, don't get too excited, though, because it's still not worth enough for someone to buy through it, except in some rare instances. And it also might add more value to the three. When overtime was last changed, which was 2012, I believe, it took some of the value away from the three and shifted it to the six. This was largely due to teams not attempting long field goals on the opening drive, since a miss gives their opponent the ball at the spot of where the kick was attempted, and even a made field goal still gives their opponent another chance to drive and score. But now with the overtime period being shorter, coaches may make that long field goal attempt in the current overtime, 10-minute overtime, because they won't have that much time on offense if they were to get the ball back again.
Very good. We're taping this show on the Tuesday before game one of the NFL season. At this point, Zeke Elliott of the Cowboys is facing a 6-game suspension, which is under appeal. And it could get messy and drag on for a long time. Right now, we don't know if he's going to be able to play while the appeals process works its way through the system or not. Here's my question. Assume the Cowboys are a 3-point favorite over some team with Elliott playing. If he's out, how much does that affect the line?
Well, Zeke Elliott definitely had a phenomenal season last year for the Cowboys, and he seemingly was a key cog for the Dallas offense. However, the truth is, he's actually worth very little to the overall point spread of a game. And not just him particularly, but running backs in general. Good running backs are worth about 1 to 2 points to the point spread. The reason for this is primarily because the running game in the NFL is largely a product of the offensive line and the coordination of the offense. The drop-off from a primary running back to the secondary running back is just not that large. Now, in the example you gave, 3 might be a tough example because we know from past conversations that the 3 is the most valuable number in terms of the point spread. So if the number was more like 5, and Zeke Elliott was assumed to be playing, but now he's going to be out, that number may drop down to, say, 3.5, just, you know, between 1 and 2 points. In the case of the current line, and I think that we're going to know by the end of today, I think the NFL is going to rule on the status of the suspension. The current line is I believe it's Dallas minus 3.5. And it's kind of assumed for Elliott to be out. That line actually opened at Dallas minus 6. So the line's already moved, and if Elliott plays, then that line's going to shift back up probably more to like Dallas minus 5.5 or so. But if he's out, I don't actually expect that one to move through the 3. It'll just be too much of a movement. If it does, however, that might actually give you a lot more value on Dallas. If that gets down to like Dallas minus 2.5 with Ezekiel Elliott out, I would say that gives a lot of value to Dallas.
Now, what about Odell Beckham Jr., who's a wide receiver and maybe the best offensive player for Dallas's opponent this Sunday? He may be out. I don't know what the latest on him is. Would that make a difference point-wise?
Right. So that's actually a good point. So a wide receiver is actually worth a little bit more than a running back. And wide receivers are typically worth 2 to 3 points on average. Now, I know these don't sound like large scale movements when you consider that these are kind of the show names of these two teams. However, that's kind of how the NFL works. It's the backup position often has a lot of the same skills. Where that kind of breaks down is at quarterback. Quarterbacks are often far superior to the backup quarterback. And we see that example definitely with the Indianapolis Colts in week 1. Before the season started, you know, well, back in the summertime when they came out with the lines for these games, the Colts were, I think, a minus 3-point favorite on the road in L.A. against the Rams. That was assumed that Andrew Luck would be playing. Now, however, Andrew Luck is out, and that line is now Rams minus 3.5. So that line has like 6.5 points already. And it's actually probably going to move more because the public is definitely going to look at the situation and say, the Colts led by Scott Tolzien, this can't work. You know, I'm definitely betting the Rams, and especially when you consider L.A. money coming in on the Rams there in Vegas. So I would actually expect that one to move even further as we get closer to game time. With the Rams becoming a higher favorite. The tricky part with kind of being a sports bettor is to know the impact of each of these players on a line. You know, some of it is quantifiable. Some of it is qualitative, where you just kind of have this feeling for how much it'll affect it. I've always said that the hidden value in the effect on the point spread is the offensive line. The offensive line actually has the greatest impact to how the offense operates in a given game. And so if you have like a center or, you know, the right guard out, that greatly affects how a team is going to be able to block in order to set up the running game, which then sets up the passing game. So that can often be kind of some hidden values when you hear that an offensive guard might be out for a game. There could definitely be value to be had because the public usually doesn't react to these players they've never heard the name of before.
I want to go back to what you said about the L.A. money coming in Vegas. So I was under the impression that the Vegas books basically just aped whatever they saw going on at Pinnacle and the places offshore. So, and I wouldn't think that the L.A. money would affect those places offshore. So is there enough of it that the point spread in Vegas would get out of whack from the offshore books because of something like L.A. money?
It does happen. We saw the Rams kind of move back to L.A. last year, and that was the first year we kind of had to test out that theory. And to be honest with you, they didn't greatly move the line in Vegas. However, now we have the Raiders, who are moving to Vegas in two, maybe more likely 3 years. And they are actually already moving the line. There's just been a ton of Raider money in Vegas. And Vegas has had to take a position on the Raiders. Before this week, back when there was not so much action down on week one of the NFL, the Raiders were actually the favorite in their game at Tennessee this week, whereas offshore, Tennessee was the favorite. Now, the zero is not worth that much, but when offshore, Pinnacle has Tennessee minus 1.5 and shops in Vegas had Raiders minus 1.5, you can really see that, Vegas is starting to kind of cower to the hometown money coming in. Now, in the week that's followed, now that we're in game week, now the difference is only roughly 1 point. Offshore, it's Tennessee minus two, and in Vegas, it's Tennessee minus one. So it's starting to even out a little bit. But, again, the Raiders are still 2 to 3 years away from actually being the Vegas hometown team.
So just as a basic strategy, then, you sort of want to start from the point of bet against the Raiders?
Well, I hate to use that as a blanket statement, but there might be opportunity in the coming years for that to be a pretty good point of start for a strategy, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you would need more than that, but it sounds like I would need an extra reason to bet on the Raiders as opposed to whoever they're playing.
Yeah, you're probably going to pay a premium to bet on the Raiders, yeah.
All right, next we're going to do something a little bit unusual, and that is I'm going to ask a sports question, but ask Richard for his answer first, simply because
to show how dumb he
is, and we were talking about how dumb he was off the air, and so, and that's about the Mayweather-McGregor fight. In the afternoon of the fight, the story goes that Floyd Mayweather attempted to lay $400,000 on the fight, lasting under 9.5 rounds. The M was trying to figure out whether or not to let him take that bet. So he said, never mind, let me bet the fight will end by knockout. The M hadn't made a decision on that when Mayweather left in frustration. Do you have any opinion on whether a fighter should be allowed to make bets like that on himself? Richard.
Yeah, I do. I think that he should be allowed to bet on himself to win. I do not think he should be allowed to bet against himself, obviously. But I also don't think he should be allowed to bet on the over-under, because that's something that he has some amount of control over. Now, I got the impression, watching the fight, that he was in complete control of the fight, and the first three rounds, he basically just sort of did the rope-a-dope because fans would have been infuriated if he had knocked McGregor out in the first round or two. So I felt like he felt he could end the fight whenever he wanted, and he decided on the 10th round. It would not surprise me at all if he had been able to bet under 9.5 if that fight would have ended sooner. It certainly looked to me like he had the ability to end it sooner had he wanted to. So if I were the book, I would not have taken a bet on the over-under from him. The knockout, I think he may have had less control over, but I probably wouldn't have, you know, I certainly wouldn't have allowed him to bet no knockout. and probably wouldn't have allowed him to bet knockout either.
Jack.
Yeah, I mean, my only comment here is the absurdity that surrounded this fight from the beginning to the end. I mean, it was truly a circus, and the likes of which we haven't seen in a while. I don't know who really pulls the strings at Mayweather Productions, which was the company that kind of promoted this fight, but they're kind of a mad genius. Just every little thing. I mean, you know, you had people leaking on Twitter that Mayweather had gotten knocked out in a sparring match. And then some astute minds on Twitter realized that they said the same thing at the exact same time before the fight when he faced Pacquiao 2 years ago. You know, it was all a circus. It was all a show. It was a great opportunity for APs because the liquidity on this was insanely huge. You guys covered it well a couple weeks ago with Anthony Curtis. But this was kind of a situation where a sharp bettor could bet as much as he wanted, wherever he wanted. And sports books were welcoming the money.
I was such a sharp bettor. I got down $20. I bet $20 on Mayweather. It was a social event with a brother-in-law who just wanted to put some money down to make it interesting and to cover his pay-per-view if he won. So. So just on the social, but I did not go out and put a large amount down. Did you, Richard?
I did not. No.
What? How can we call ourselves AP when this is the AP event of the year?
Well, I mean, I know a lot of people that put down a lot more than they normally bet on a fight, or they bet on the fight that they're normally not a boxing fan to bet. But it was pretty clear that a guy that has never boxed professionally before versus a guy that has never lost boxing professionally, just was an insane mismatch. And, you know, the fact that, you know, you could walk into any casino where you're usually persona non grata and walk into the sports book and, you know, whip out as much money as you can possibly stuff in your pants. It was a unique situation.
On that evening before the fight, Bonnie and I were having dinner at the South Point, and Ryan Growney walked up. Ryan is the general manager of the South Point. He said he was going to the fight with Michael Gunn, and that they had made the decision to take a position. And that, you know, if McGregor pulled the upset, they were going to take a really, really huge bath. And they almost never do this on sporting events. They usually want the money on both sides and they'll take their small guaranteed profit in the middle. But they said we had a huge position. And if McGregor pulls the upset, we're really hurting. So I suspect that was true to a lot of books. All right, moving on. We had a question from a listener, and he wanted to know what was the significance of beating the closing line by sports.
So this is actually an astute question, because the significance of beating the closing line is the best way to gauge your ability to beat a market without depending on just the variance of bet results. In other words, someone who consistently gets a better price than what the games ultimately go off at, but doesn't have, you know, better than a break-even record can probably take consolation in their ability more than someone who has a winning record, but the market constantly moves against them after they bet. As the listener suspected, it does depend on the sport, though. So more importantly, the efficiency of each sport's market. Like in a sport where there is a lot of liquidity, such as big games in the NFL, like a Monday Night Football game, there's a chance that the square money will keep the market inefficient to the point where the sharp money doesn't noticeably move the line. Conversely, in a sport where there is very little betting action, let's say the WNBA, the sharp action moves the market more substantially. This kind of dovetails back to the Mayweather-McGregor fight and what made it so great for APs. It was the rare instance where the market was absolutely flooded with square money on McGregor to the point where sportsbooks had no choice but to move the line in that direction, whether or not they wanted to take a position on the fight, just because the market was so vast. I saw an interview with Jay Cornegay of the Westgate, and he basically said this was one of the easiest events to ever book, because when they wanted action on either side, they just moved their line just a little bit, and the money came pouring in. The McGregor money came pouring in drips and drabs of 20s and 100s, and the Mayweather money came pouring in 5 and 6 figure bets. So beating the closing line is definitely a way to kind of gauge your ability in handicapping a sport.
Another listener wanted to know about using bitcoins for sports betting, presumably for anonymity purposes.
Yeah, I'm far from a Bitcoin expert. However, I do strongly think that it's very effective for getting money in and out of sports books in our current day and age. I personally keep very little money in Bitcoin. Instead, I choose to keep my money in sports books and then move it in and out when necessary. You do encounter fees for transferring Bitcoin, but in my opinion, the ease of moving money in an industry that's always been very tough to move money in makes the transfer fees money well spent. For U.S. listeners, the most customer friendly Bitcoin wallet / exchange is called Coinbase. They have an app that you can use on your smartphone, and you can set up a wallet and fund it via credit card for small amounts or via a bank transfer for larger amounts. The bank transfers take about 2 weeks, though. But from there, you go to your chosen online sports books, and they will likely have very easy to follow Bitcoin deposit instructions. And they'll usually offer a deposit bonus on Bitcoin as well. They'll give you a code that you can scan with your phone on your smartphone, with the camera. And basically you send the Bitcoin to that address. And then within a short period of time, that deposit shows up in your sportsbook balance. Withdrawals are usually just as simple. You just give them your wallet address and they send the money over. For sportsbooks, this is actually a huge improvement over the hit or miss payment processors that they've had to deal with since Black Friday. Now, let me preface that a Bitcoin expert would probably have a lot more to add to this whole process. They'd probably tell you that you need to use a hardware wallet because they're more secure, or you need to use a better exchange because they have a lower transfer fee. And yes, those are all definitely improvements. However, in the listener's case, as well as my own case, we're not looking forward to keeping a lot of money in Bitcoin or investing in Bitcoin or speculating Bitcoin. We just prefer to have that as a tool to transfer money. And the world of Bitcoin is very vast, and hopefully someday you can have a Bitcoin expert on, because it's kind of a fascinating dynamic. But when it comes to using it strictly as a currency transactional tool, it's pretty straightforward and it's actually very effective.
I have a couple of questions about that. First of all, I want to say to the listener, the idea of you being able to do this anonymously, it's not. Theoretically, it is possible to make an exchange of Bitcoins anonymously, but it would be extremely, extremely difficult. And you should assume that the government knows about your Bitcoin transactions. Second, I would not park my money in Coinbase. It's pretty easy to take your money, your Bitcoin, out of Coinbase if you're leaving it in Bitcoin. And then if you're going to transfer it back to Coinbase and then back to a casino or whatever. But because of what happened with Mt. Gox, which was another big exchange, a lot of people lost a lot of money, I really would not leave it parked there in the Coinbase account. also Coinbase, because they've been expanding so rapidly, there have been lots and lots of complaints about Coinbase in 2017. But I have a question for you, and that is, the government aside, is it possible to set up a sportsbook account anonymously using Bitcoin, or do you still have to go through all the rigmarole of showing them your ID and all that stuff for the various books and or casinos?
Well, like anything in the AP world, it depends. There is the ability out there with using Bitcoin that they don't get so hung up with their payment processors like they used to. I think the offshore sportsbook world is definitely a little bit more relaxed now that they're not losing so much of their profits due to payment processor money being seized and things like that. So I have seen, much to my delight, that there is less scrutiny over withdrawal processing than there used to be. You know, it used to be you had to send them a picture of your ID and a utility bill with that address and things like that. Now, that's not to say that if they suspect you of, you know, using beards or multiple accounts, they're not going to investigate you. And they definitely have much more sophisticated IP tracking than they used to. But for one thing, with Bitcoin, it seems to be a little bit easier, less scrutiny when it comes to deposits and withdrawals.
Okay, but if they suspect you're multi-accounting, you're still going to have the same hassles that
right. always do. Yeah, I wouldn't suggest multi-accounting with any of the bigger books. They're very astute in tracking not only your IP address, but the MAC address and things like that to dig a little deeper. So that you can't just, you know, spoof your IP address to get past them anymore.
Have you dabbled with any of the internet casinos using Bitcoin?
I have not. Since I live in New Jersey, it's illegal for me to place a wager in an internet casino now. We do have the online casinos here regulated within the state, which we talked about last time I was on the show. So I have not played on any of the internet casinos since then.
In your write-ups to talking about this, you said you prefer to have your money working in a sportsbook account. Now, I can see you holding, you know, five or six figures in a sportsbook if you regularly make bets that size. But when you say working in a sportsbook, do they pay interest? Do they give you benefits for having a big account? What did you mean by that?
Right. I strictly meant just having it as a tool that's handy to use. So, you know, for instance, the Mayweather fight, I pretty much found all my liquid capital in some of these sports books and I put it, you know, right down on Mayweather as much as they would take. But you're right, Bob. If you're in a situation where they're not giving you interest and you're not using all of those funds on a regular basis, then it is, it's sort of like, you know, keeping your bankroll under your mattress. It's not doing anybody any good there. So, you know, put it in something where it's working a little harder for you. Yes.
All right. Another listener. What is the general status of online sportsbooks?
So, currently, it's actually not too bad. You know, I don't want to endorse any specific sports book because, you know, if you're a winning sports bettor, you're going to get limited in some way. You're going to get backed off. You're going to get your maximum bet size to be something ridiculously small. You're going to get told they don't want your action anymore. Pretty much every sports book works that way, both in Vegas as well as offshore, save for one, and that's Pinnacle. And as probably some of your listeners are already aware, Pinnacle takes big action and they're willing to take big action because, if you're able to beat them, they're going to make much more from learning about how you beat them than you'll ever make in beating them. But for the most part, you know, the online offshore, sports books right now are probably in a little better position than they were right after Black Friday. Right after that, a lot of them shriveled up and died. A lot of the scam books, you know, kind of prospered right after Black Friday because people were so desperate to try to get money down. But now we have several big names that have remained, and for the most part, they're generally pretty fair. Like I said, with things like Bitcoin, transferring money in and out is easier than it was before. So for anyone that's looking to get started, with offshore sports books, the first thing you want to do is you want to Google any sports book name to find the good and the bad buzz about them. And there's going to be both good and bad. There's probably going to be more bad because people have a higher tendency to write a bad review or a comment about that if they have a bad experience than if they have a good one. And then, you know, for the casual or aspiring sports bettors, I'd stick with the bigger names. You know, you probably don't need that many places to bet when you're first starting out. Now, for someone who's more serious, you're only as good as the outs that you have to bet against. And just like in any other form of AP, getting the money down is the true art of the process. So they're going to have to be a little bit more creative in finding some books that have looser lines or that are a little off, and they'll have to, you know, weigh those risks of using different ventures to get their money down.
Very good. New Jersey sports betting cases. It's seems to be coming to an end. What's going to happen?
So, and this has gone on for, and as a New Jersey resident, and I can tell you, this has gone on for over a decade now since they first started the push to have a repeal of the change of the constitutional law to allow sports betting. And New Jersey has lost at every turn in the road, so far. However, what's happened now is that it's reached the docket of the Supreme Court of the United States. And that means that at least four of the justices believe that New Jersey's case has enough constitutional impact to require being heard. Currently, the written briefs are being submitted, and New Jersey has submitted theirs, and the leagues, which are the other party in this process, the leagues have 35 days to answer, and then sometime this fall, oral arguments are going to be held, and we can expect a verdict in the first few months of 2018. And despite everything that's gone on so far here, and New Jersey's like 0-6 in court cases here so far, New Jersey's actually finally a favorite in the case. We've reached the point where the constitutionality of PASPA, and we've discussed that before, that's the federal law that prohibits sports betting except in four states, Nevada, Oregon, Delaware, and Montana. We've reached the point where the constitutionality of PASPA is finally being debated. Does PASPA infringe on states' rights to control their commerce? Does it give other states an unfair advantage? Given the current makeup of the court, there are many who believe the court will side with New Jersey and strike down PASPA. At that point, states who have passed laws legalizing sports betting, if PASPA is ever repealed, would be able to spring into action. Now, if the Supreme Court sides with the leagues, we're realistically looking at 2019 before Congress acts. This is just too risky of a law to pass in 2018, which is also the same year as midterm elections. Congress really gets nothing done in midterm election years. So we've kind of reached the point where New Jersey's a favorite, and if it doesn't pass via that, then you know, possibly federal framework would be put into place that would partially repeal PASPA and create a, you know, a different situation where states would have the option of legalizing sports betting. There's a caveat here, and that is there's a best case scenario and there's a worst case scenario on how this can go. And one is very good and one is very bad. The dream scenario for APs or even avid sports bettors is that we'll have a decentralized sports betting market with high liquidity. The first key to developing this would be New Jersey prevailing in court and states rushing to get this new tax revenue stream up and running. Many states would probably say sports betting can only take place in established casinos, for example. So now we have quite a few states with new sports betting operations, and assuming that William Hill or Cantor Gaming or Betfair don't sweep in and buy them all up, we're going to have plenty of new independent sportsbook operators. This could lead to geographic market inefficiencies, similar to how we talked about with the Raiders a few minutes ago, but on a probably a much bigger scale. I have a friend actually who, he's a past guest of this show who's been involved in options trading for a long time. And he told me a while back that, back when there were many options exchanges, you could often find price inefficiencies between different exchanges in different cities. Similarly with sports betting, you'd be able to find price inefficiency in different areas of the country due to the overwhelming square action in some of those areas. For instance, if you were to go to, say, Hollywood Columbus Casino in Columbus, Ohio, right next to Ohio State University, you'd probably get the best number on whoever Ohio State was playing that weekend. Visiting Windstar Casino in Thackerville, Oklahoma, you'd likely find the best line on whoever the Sooners are playing, or even whoever the Oklahoma City Thunder are facing.
Or even Dallas.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Yeah, that's their big draw there. Back when Delaware first instituted parlay betting on the NFL back in 2009, they did this. They heavily shaded their line in anticipation of local favorites. The Ravens, the Redskins, the Eagles, they were always priced at least a point off the consensus market line, even though the key number, even through key numbers such as three. Now, by the second season of operation, they reverted back to just following the market consensus, because they studied it and found that their profits would be better staying more neutral. However, in a prolific, decentralized sports betting world full of independent operators, they're either going to proactively shade their lines or the lopsided action that they receive is going to force them to reactively shade their lines. So it could be very interesting, and especially now that we live in a world where the mobile sports betting app exists, and that could create the ability for, you know, someone like myself in one state to be able to hopefully get down on something in another state where all the action is already lopsided.
Yeah, when I was a teenager in Chicago, there were guys who had connections, you know, to others, and back then everything was just your local bookie, so. You know, they would bet against Chicago in Chicago and, you know, against Dallas in Dallas and, you know, when they were playing each other and often have really good middle situations because the lines were so skewed.
Right. Now, unfortunately, the worst case scenario is pretty bad, and it's probably not a stretch of the imagination to see this coming to fruition. We discussed the last time I was on the show that the sports leagues mainly oppose legalized betting on their games because they get no piece of the action. They preach protecting the integrity of the game, but as we've seen with Daily Fantasy, they're open to gambling on their games if they get a cut. If New Jersey prevails in the Supreme Court, you can look for the leagues to pivot and begin to push for federal framework regarding sports betting. They'll claim this is also to protect the integrity of the game, but really what they want is a federal law that says sportsbooks must license the brand the leagues provide. A number that has been kicked around before is 2% of handle. In other words, 2 cents of every $1 wagered goes to the league and to the league that wager is placed on. The federal government may also want to institute a small tax to run whatever federal agency is overseeing sports betting. So that might be another 1% of handle. And now we get to the states who, as long as they stay within the framework, can regulate sports betting however they see it. And unfortunately, states have a really bad habit of using gambling tax revenue as a band-aid for whatever budget deficiency they've worked their way into. On top of that, they tend to overproject and overtax the revenue stream. So you can expect some states to tax their sports betting revenue at a higher rate than other casino revenue. And when you add all this together, it becomes increasingly likely that minus 110 VIG, which represents roughly a 4.5% house edge, might be too thin to ensure profitability for a casino. We might be seeing minus 115, minus 120 as the normal standard line. And now you've effectively doubled the house edge for the casual bettor. As we've seen with 6-5 blackjack, the public will still play the game, but it creates a buzzsaw effect. The casual bettor gets grinded out by the VIG too quickly, and it greatly discourages their desire to continue to play. It also creates less liquidity, which in turn hurts the sharp bettors. And this would actually be a boon to offshore operations, too. They would, through their lower margins, would still be able to offer the minus 110 or lower. So, in essence, the leagues, through their greed, would actually be encouraging illegal gambling to thrive instead of preventing it from occurring.
You mentioned you might get a better line in Ohio, betting against Ohio State. But unless you can do it online, it's hardly going to be worth enough to fly to Ohio to bet against Ohio State and then fly to Oklahoma City.
Come on, Bob. We own telephones. You must know somebody who lives in Ohio.
Uh-huh. So you have teams now.
Yeah. Wouldn't you? I mean,
yes. Yes, there would be teams.
Yeah,
and if we're talking the kind of lopsided liquidity that probably would occur in places like that, the sports book would be all too welcome to take your action too. So getting down five figures or more on whoever Ohio State is playing might be relatively simple. When I started betting in Delaware, I was betting with a pretty good edge, and I was always concerned that, oh, they're going to back me off. They're going to back me off. Well, finally, one day they cornered me in the casino, and I was like, oh, here it comes. And he said, hey, I just wanted to thank you. You're on the side we need all the time, and we really appreciate your action. So if there's anything I can do to help, just let me know, which, you know, for an AP is very rare when a casino personnel tells you that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it doesn't happen to me every day, that's for sure. All right, we're talking to Captain Jack. We have five more questions for him, but first we're going to do a few commercials. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. September, there are two casino-wide progressives going at all times. The big one starts at $10,000 and must go off by $25,000. If you're playing with your card in any machine on the property, and you've played at least $1 in the last minute, you'll get $25 in free play when it goes off. The progressive then resets at $10,000 and begins to climb again. The second progressive starts at $1,000 and must be hit by $2,500. It's expected it will go off approximately 3 times per day. Week 7 of the free video poker classes, Wednesday, September 13th, will be 9-6 double-double bonus Ultimate X. This is a 99.86 game. It's the highest returning video poker game in the casino. Ultimate X is a 10 coin per line game where each score earns a multiplier on the next hand. In the double-double bonus version, Full House earns you a 12x multiplier. On the next hand, the straight earns you an 8x multiplier. This kind of thing varies by game. The best games are 10 play, and they have some of those. But they also have it in 5-play and 3-play versions in the lobby bar on an all-star poker machine. The strategy for the game, taking into the account the multipliers, is very similar to 10-7 double bonus. This will be one class only, taught at the intermediate level. The class will be held in the Silverado Lounge, which is the first lounge you come to entering from the parking garage. Everyone at least 21 years of age and older is welcome. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Spin Poker Dream Card. Dream Card, 10 coins per line game, where periodically the fifth card you receive is a dream card, where the machine turns that card into the best possible one given the first four. should you disagree with a card selected, and occasionally is right to disagree. You can change it to any of the other 47 available cards. Spin poker is a 9-line game where the pay line zig and zag. Spin poker doesn't change the return on the game or the strategy. All right. We've been talking with Captain Jack about sports betting related subjects. So in Stanford Wong's Sharp Sports Betting, he talked about teasers. Is that still a viable betting strategy?
As a matter of fact, it is. Teasing a point spread through key numbers, such as the 3 and the 7, is still a good wager. However, teaser bets of all kinds ran exceptionally hot last year. And it was mostly due to randomness. But there were some weeks where bettors who placed a super teaser, which is when you add 10 points to either side of the point spread, they won every bet, because if you add 10 points to both sides, the game still finished within 10 points of the point spread, and they won both sides. And apparently that's actually something a lot of square bettors do, is they'll just bet both sides of a teaser and hope it lands in the middle. So that meant there were some weeks last year where sports books lost every single super teaser they booked. And they actually started to whine a bit about it. It got really bad in October and November, and it rebounded a little bit for them in December. But for the most part, sportsbooks lost money booking teasers last year, and that led to what some would call a market reaction, what I would call an overreaction, and many of the sportsbooks this year have actually lowered their odds on teasers. So I haven't actually taken too thorough of a survey around Las Vegas, but I do know that offshore the odds have definitely dropped, and if you are a teaser player, you may want to recheck those odds at your favorite sports book before you start wagering this year. And for anyone unfamiliar with teasers, I still think Sharp Sports Betting by Stanford Wong is an essential read for anyone that wants to get involved in sports betting in any way. The book was written in 2000, I believe. I believe he updated it slightly in 2010. It still holds value. Some of the concepts might have drifted away by now, but for the aspiring sports bettor, it's still an essential read.
You were last on our show in November of 2016. Have you come across any new resources for learning more about sports betting since then?
As a matter of fact, in February of this year, a new network dedicated to sports betting information began broadcasting from the South Point Casino, actually. I believe you mentioned them on the show before. It's called VSIN. It stands for Vegas Stats and Information Network. And it broadcasts from a little glass booth next to the sports book. They broadcast on Sirius XM radio as well as visually on VSIN.com. They live stream the show there. They bill themselves as kind of the CNBC for sports bettors. And so far, I have to admit, the product has been a pleasant surprise. They're not on there selling picks. They don't have touts on the show. They kind of have an anti-tout mentality. So you don't have to worry about it just being constant noise from people trying to sell you something. Their flagship program is hosted by longtime broadcaster Brent Musburger. And his caliber of guests is unexpectedly high. He has, Fox Sports analysts and like the former NFL referee Mike Pereira comes on there and he talks about rule changes and things like that, and they're very careful with non betting guests. They don't really talk betting, but they talk about angles that a sports bettor would want to hear, and then with guests that have more relation with betting, they'll talk about the real meat and potatoes of line movements and things like that. Some of the value that I found on it is they often have the sportsbook directors and managers from all the Vegas sportsbooks in the studio to talk about line moves, line movement. You could tell, especially leading up to that Mayweather-McGregor fight, they could tell you, here's where the line's going to go. We're going to drop our straddle to this amount by day of fight. It was actually some very quantifiable information that was useful to somebody that was looking to put large money down on that. Now their target audience is still aspiring recreational sports bettors. So you can't expect all the conversations to be sharp. And I'm sure a lot of people in this audience would probably think that, this tends to be a little too square for my liking. But, they broadcast live from 4 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific each day. Yes, that's right. 4 a.m. they start their live broadcasts. And, the South Point Sportsbook is actually open 24 hours. So, I've tuned in to see what does a sportsbook look like at 4 a.m. because I'm never up at that hour. And, it is indeed. There are people that are in there either watching replays or looking at lines. There's a constant trickle to the counter behind them, which is kind of fascinating to watch. But anyone who's interested in learning more about sports betting in general could probably benefit from listening once in a while to some of their shows.
I'm actually in conversation with them to both be a guest on their show and trying to get Brent to be a guest on this show. So the first show I'm on there will probably be one hosted by Mitch Moss, who has been a Las Vegas ESPN radio DJ for a long time, and he did a stint in San Francisco for a while. But they have a number. I mean, Brent Musburger is not there those long hours. He's only there for relatively few hours of that. But they have programming with other people. And Brent would sure be wonderful to get on this show.
Yeah, I believe Brent is 3 to 5 p.m. each day. Mitch Moss is actually the guy that heads up that 4 a.m. show. So, Bob, good luck waking up for that show. Or staying up for that show.
You play those hours anyway, Bob. So that
I actually do. There's a without going into great detail, I'm frequently out between midnight and 6 a.m. At a somewhere. So just have to head in a slightly different direction. The South Point, so I don't know, 6 miles from my house or so. All right. In week one of the NFL season, the Jets play at the Bills. Both are going to be pretty bad teams. But as of a couple days ago, the Bills were favored by 8. Now, assuming you have no handicapping feel as to whether 8 is too high or too low, would you ever place a bet on that game? And if so, what are some of the factors that would lead you to do this?
Right. So we're going to see this a lot this year with this Jets team. They're going to be historically bad, and they've pretty much indicated that they're tanking this season, just on everything they've done so far. So, and they have some key injuries on top of that even. But in this case, you have a Bills team which is not that great, and they're favored by 8, which is huge. This is a key opportunity for a Wong teaser. You have a Bills team that is -8 at home. You tease them down to -2. Now you have to pair them with another team at least. If you can still find it, New England -8, -8.5 is a good one. You tease that down to -2, -2.5. That line's moving towards 9 though. If you can't get that, there are some other options. Teasing some home teams up that are home dogs. Detroit +2, you could tease that to +8. Washington +1.5, you could tease that to +7.5. Another one that I've worked with for this week was Miami, but with the hurricane bearing down, it looks very unlikely that game is going to go off as scheduled in Miami. But Miami was basically a 2.5-point dog at home to Tampa Bay, and you could tease that up to 8.5. But again, it doesn't look likely that game is going to go off as scheduled, and they're not sure if it's going to be moved to another venue, which would void all tickets, or if it gets moved to another time, which, depending on the sportsbook rule, might actually make that game still have action if it's within 1 week of the scheduled time, which last I heard is they might play it as soon as Thursday, So by the time your listeners hear this, that game might have already been played anyway.
Would you ever tease the other direction, going from 8 up to 15 or something like that?
Right. So the other numbers involved in that just don't have enough value. The 9, the 11, the 12, they just don't have any value whatsoever. Games rarely land on those numbers. Now the 10, the 13, and the 14, they have some value, but as you drift further away from the small numbers, the value becomes less and less on even those key numbers. So there's just not enough value to tease in the other direction, no. And same way, you wouldn't tease a total. You're just not getting enough value teasing. I think the total in this game is like 40. You're just not getting enough value teasing up to 46 or down to 34.
Very good. We've been talking to Captain Jack. We're out of our questions. Is there any last information you wanted to give to our listeners before we let you go?
I can't think of anything, but if you want to have me back sometime, I'm more than happy to talk sports betting. My wife is tired of me talking sports betting all the time, so it's fun to find somebody to talk about it with.
Good. Maybe we can talk basketball when that starts.
Sure, definitely.
The NBA is about to start. Are you enough of an NBA bettor that you would have teams that you think are going to go better than expected or worse than expected?
So my type of handicapping is largely market efficiency. So I don't really handicap the teams per se. I do look into various roster changes and how they affect how a team might run their offense this coming year, but I don't handicap the exact teams. I look for opportunities where market inefficiency creates something that might not be factored in, or a metric that is not readily available to the lines maker that might enable me to more accurately predict or project a result. Either through a linear regression or a logistic regression. So I kind of, I don't want to get lost in the weeds of all the numbers, but I tend to just think more in terms of the quantitative analysis rather than which teams I think will be better or worse than expected.
Very good. This is very informative. Thank you very much, Captain Jack. We'll be sure to have you again. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.